Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddham Namam Sangham Namasami. So it's the full moon night where 2/3 of the way through the Vasa for most of us. And it's been quite a special day today. We had the two very senior visiting Thai Ajahns. And it was very nice for the nuns. We were invited to come in at the end of the Patimokkha recitation and pay respects to the Ajahns and listen to some words of encouragement regarding the Vinaya and its fundamental importance in our lives as monks and nuns. And listening to the precepts just now, of course, it's crucial for all of us, this foundation of sila. And, at the moment, I feel surrounded by people who are unwell and who are suffering from the vicissitudes of old age. And facing up to the limitations of the body. And I find it very sobering and grounding, you know, to be with people who are not well, to hear stories of people who are dealing with terminal illnesses and struggling with the body, the aging body. I feel really grateful to have the opportunity to connect with a lot of people who are the Devadutas, you know, the heavenly messengers. Who are contending with these almost, you could say, inevitable situations. We won't all get sick, but we're all going to get old. Well, we will either get sick or we'll get old, or both, and we'll all die, of course. And I'm very grateful to have, you know, the opportunity to connect with people like this because... so many people, of course, because I'm relatively fit, you know, and young. And it's easy to take that for granted, which I do, actually. I think it's really hard to imagine being otherwise until we are. And so it just helps. It helps to incline the mind in this direction. And when I take in the situations of other people who are struggling physically, coming to terms with the limitations of the body, facing up to mortality. It helps me to focus my energies more fully on that which is liberating. And so many things can fall away. So many things. So many, not so much the things we do. I'm more meaning the ways we spend our time thinking and the kind of things that obsess the mind. Like Ajahn Amaru was talking in his last Dharma talk here in the temple about the how to contend, how to work with thinking skillfully. So much of our attention, you know, we can spend on things that are not so helpful, not so important in the long run. And then we just chanted the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the very first teaching of the Lord Buddha, which says it all. And that's worth spending lots of time pondering, I feel, and considering from every angle. It seems to me to be endless, the ramifications, the depth, the profundity, the guidance right there in that first teaching. Actually, it's really awesome. And I don't know, there's so many things one could say. I've been considering since the family camp, actually. We had a wonderful family camp this year at the end of August, just recently. And one of the things that happened in the family camp was that there were many things created, many wonderful opportunities for the kids and the parents to be creative. And we had the creative work happening around Dharma themes. So this is really educational, of course. And one of the things that was created was this giant bird, which some of you might have seen because it's still in the field. You can go and have a look at it. I think it's still there. And it's near the marquee. And it's a beautiful structure. It's made of lots of slivers of wood nailed to a sort of frame, a central frame, like a cross-shaped frame. And it's got these magnificent wings. They're very bird-like. It really looks like a bird, and it's like a sort of, makes me think of American Indian totem poles. Anyway, this got created, and then at the end of the family camp, there was a gathering on the second to last day, and Ajahn Amaru gave was invited to give some reflections, and to explain why did they build this, why did they create this bird, what was that about? And he explained the simile of the five friends, the five indriya, and also you can call them the five powers, five bala, when they're more fully developed. These are the aspects that help us in our meditation and that grow as we practice. And as Ajahn explained, the head of the bird and the body, the main bulk of the bird is sati, is mindfulness, remembering, awareness. And this was the theme of the entire family camp, mindfulness. So this is the body of the bird, most of the bird, but then there are the wings, these magnificent wings that they made. And the simile is that the wings can represent the other four friends, two pairs. The first pair is Panya, wisdom, and Sada, which is could be translated as faith or as devotion or confidence. And as the Ajahn explained, they balance each other out. You sort of, in a way, you can't have one without the other. Or if you do, you're not going to get very far. Not going to be able to fly. And then, joining the wings to the body, the other two friends, the friends that enable the connection between the wings and the body. Virya, which is effort or energy, and samadhi, which is concentration, focus, one-pointedness. And I don't know about you, I have quite a visual mind. I find images really helpful. And so this has stayed with me, the bird. I hadn't actually heard that simile before. And coming back to all the Devaduttas that I'm fortunate to be in contact with, I've been exploring the relationship between focusing attention. Because I find being with people who are struggling, it really focuses my energy and my attention. And the interplay between these two. I often talk to people about their meditation practice, and a lot of people struggle with restlessness. Like Ajahn Amaru was talking about thinking, so many people ask me how to stop thinking, how to deal with thinking. And so it's really wonderful to have all the strategies that he gave. And these two aspects, these two friends, when there's a lot of thinking, a lot of restlessness, the remedy the Buddha gave, one of the ways to work with this, he said, is to focus the energy, focus the awareness, concentrate the mind, bring it to one-pointedness. You know. So I often find myself suggesting this to people: if there's a lot of agitation, restlessness, distraction in the mind, and life in the monastery, although you know we're in a peaceful place. But still we can feel busy, we can feel full of, you know, the duties and the responsibilities we have, a lot of thinking, a lot of even planning, and even obsessing about the things we have to do. And mostly all of this comes from a very good place, but it's a sort of my experience of restless mind is circular. It sort of goes round and round in circles. And obsessing over things doesn't lend to peacefulness or well-being. So this encouragement to focus, to bring the attention to narrow it down, I find really helpful. And it's the concentration part. It's the aspect of concentration as a balance to energy. When there's too much energy, It tends to scatter and dissipate and fragment. And so then the concentration can come in and bring things together, channel the energy. And simply put, you know, concentrating on the breath or some small part of the body, narrowing down the body awareness to a particular aspect of the body, say the breathing in the belly or just one tiny piece of the body where there's some feeling. That can be wonderfully peaceful, can't it? It sort of brings the mind in to a simple mode of awareness. And then, of course, when the energy is flagging, it's low, it's dull, there's a dullness or a sleepiness, it doesn't really help to focus in so much. And that sort of opening up of the awareness is then needed. And waking up, enlivening. The Buddha gave some beautiful images for effort and energy to balance the energy. And first of all, for myself, I notice when I meditate, you know, when I'm coming to sit, just to check in. You know, how is the energy right now? Is the mind dull or is it restless? Is it wandering? And in the body also, it's both mental and physical. This quality of energy, isn't it? So how clear is the body awareness? How still and peaceful can the body be? Or how much does it feel agitated? Is there agitation there? And one simile the Buddha gave was to a deva. He was talking to a deva. It's one of the, I think, it's the first verses in Samyutta Nikaya. And he's explaining how to get the right balance, middle way between effort, too much effort or too little effort. And he gives the simile of crossing the river. There's a current, quite strong current, and maybe a certain depth to the river, up to the waist perhaps. You have to get across, you have to wade across the river. And he said, if you go too fast, if you push too hard, then you'll get swept away. You'll run out of energy. You'll tire yourself out before you get to the other side. But also, if there's not enough push, if there's not enough energy, and you're going too slowly, then you'll be swept away by the current also. And it'll take too long. You'll get tired out. You won't make it to the other side. There's also the simile of the tuning of the lute or the violin or whatever, the tuning of the string, just so, just the right pitch, not too tight, not too loose. And so I've been considering energy and concentration and this balance between the two. And it's not just, you know, sitting in meditation, of course, it's applicable in every situation. So it's quite interesting. You can notice how much energy I put into, like, eating. Do I need to hold the spoon quite so hard? Brushing my teeth. Do I need to be quite so vigorous? I'm brushing my teeth. It's quite interesting. We can see how everything we do, there's an energy balance, and we can gauge, you know, how much effort do I need to make in doing this, doing the gardening or chopping the carrots? Do I need to be tense about it? And kind of even you can see sometimes a little aggressive about the way we move or the way we hold the body. Or can I afford to ease up a little bit? And equally, like the way I'm standing or walking, am I slumping over and not enabling the energy to flow in the body? Sometimes I can give a stretch and suddenly feel incredibly energized. It's very interesting. So in every situation, but also on the mental level. It's easy to calm, or maybe it isn't, but in meditation, it's easier to relax mentally also, isn't it, when we bring the attention to the body and we're sitting still and maybe observing the breath, everything can become a little bit more peaceful, maybe. But then when I'm around the monastery talking to people, doing emails, walking around, in the more interactive mode, what about then? Is it really necessary to think about everything so much? Is it possible to stop? In the middle of doing emails, I like stopping. I like to pause and just look out the window. It's amazing how much I can miss, I realize, you know, the weather or what's going on in nature. And it's a shame to miss too much of that because, well, we're creatures of nature. We're not creatures of, I don't feel quite so connected to computers. Maybe some people do. But nature feels more in tune with this body, this mind, going out amongst the trees, out in the grass, just looking out at the sky. There's we're part of this, you know. And noticing, say, the energy of being on the computer, doing the emails or talking with people, it's a different mode, and we can become very heady, can become very disembodied. Sometimes I notice myself. And so taking a little break and readjusting the energy. The energy of the internet for me is frenetic. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's just a very buzzy sort of energy. And if I go and sit in the garden, it's a very different sense and much more calming, grounding. I'm reading a book at the moment about phenomenology. It's about what it is to live in the sensory realm, to be sensory beings as we are, and the dangers of losing touch with that. We're just so fortunate. We have the Dharma teachings so that we are continually reminded to connect back into our nature, to live our natures, to feel our bodies, to see the body as part of the wholeness of nature. We're not separate. Earth element, water, fire and air. And as the Buddha said, you know, it's the same earth, water, fire and air that we find in rivers, the sky, nature, trees, the earth, water, fire, and air in this body is no different. It's the same it's the same qualities of the material world, and constantly interchanging, of course, recycling, moving around. There's nothing solid or permanent about this little piece of the material world. And it's just wonderful to be reminded of that again and again, and to experience that, you know, in our practice. And when we're eating, we get the chance, you know, to eat mindfully. So we feel, we take in the outside consciously, feel the amazing, and sense the amazing variety of places that this food has come from. The enormous amounts of energy that's gone into this food that we eat, and then it becomes part of this body and does its fuels up the body. And then it comes away, you know, the waste products come out and back into different forms. And all of this interconnectedness, this extraordinary flow, we're like a sort of channel, aren't we? We're just bringing in and seeing that material substance coming in, going out. It's just a flow, it's a stream, just like everything else in nature. And anyway, in this book, it's talking about the almost ubiquitous lack of awareness of our connectedness to the rest of nature. I don't know, I really don't know how it is for other people, because when we're practicing, and if we've been practicing for a long time, we've no idea. I can't remember. But one thing I do recall is before I started meditating, I lived in my head, most definitely. I realized, because my teacher, Goenkaji, was inviting us to, you know, scan the body, become aware of the body, sensations, feelings in the body. And truly, for me, it was a revelation, in some sense, that I had a body. Which might sound strange, but maybe some of you know what I mean. I had never really paid any attention to it. And so it was quite extraordinary to start feeling connected to this body. It's a real journey, isn't it? I mean, we know we're not the body, but before we can get to that point, we have to embody. We really benefit from body awareness. And it teaches us so much. And I suspect, though, it is true that for many people there is not that much awareness of the body. And if we're not aware of the body, if we're not living in, inhabiting this physical realm, perhaps how easy it may be to neglect to appreciate our connection with the wider field of nature. And then we can forget the balance in nature. Coming back to the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, it's interesting, you know, the whole concept of the middle way. For me, it's a very broad concept, and it just keeps coming into so many aspects of practice. The middle way in Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta is the middle way between sensory indulgence and asceticism. And this is a constant in monastic life for me. Actually, Amaravati is not exactly, how to say, it's not the most ascetic monastery. that I've spent time in. And we had this abundance of requisites here. So I notice for myself the practice is more one of trying to not be too greedy, you know, not to overindulge. But fortunately, we have opportunities to really experiment also with more ascetic ways of living. And there are the Dutanga practices, for instance, so we can decide, we can determine to just have one meal a day or not to lie down for periods of time. We can do Tudong practice, go walkabout, and in that way live on faith and live generally very simply and very much out in nature and just, you know, depend on what we're given day by day in the way of food or shelter. So these are really great opportunities, actually. And I notice myself when I get the chance to do Tudong practice, it really sharpens my mindfulness considerably and helps me in many ways. It's really inspiring. But this particular way, this particular balance between sensory indulgence and in a way renunciation or having a more minimal approach. The Buddha was really pointing through his own experience, of course, to finding the right balance between these two. And of course, he really had both extremes in his own development as the Bodhisattva. Having been brought up in great luxury, relatively great luxury, and having everything he wanted at his fingertips, more or less. And then going from that wealth and privilege to live as a beggar, as a monk. And not just as a simple monk, but rather he was interested in seeing how far he could go in giving up food, comfort. He even tried to breathe less. It's quite interesting. He experimented even with the breath to try and minimize the amount of air that he was taking. And found that, you know, these ascetic practices were not really terribly helpful in the end. So, and hence this first teaching, he was speaking to the five disciples who were still practicing in this very ascetic way, eating sort of one grain of rice a day and being extremely harsh towards this body, this material realm. And so there's this balance for me, for us maybe to consider middle way, but also the balance between these different qualities, energy and focus. It's a constantly, it's a very alive, it's a very present moment experience to notice. The degree of focus, the degree of energy, is there, you know, does there need to be a little modification here? Am I dropping off just now? Do I need to straighten up and take a deep breath? Am I restless and agitated? And do I need to just breathe out and relax, you know? It's a very interesting and fruitful inquiry, ongoing inquiry into these two energies. And how is it now? And coming back to the image of the bird, the other two balancing energies of wisdom and faith or devotion. This is also a constant for me. It's really interesting. Wisdom has that quality of, discernment, of cutting through. And it's such a beautiful quality. The skeptical mind, the rational mind that's, that which we won't believe anything until we've experienced it for ourselves. And we're the willingness to let go and discard that which is not true. And this is a very much part of the practice, isn't it? To see what we're not, to see what's not real, to come out of the illusions around permanence, around selfhood, happiness even. What really makes us happy? Is this fleeting experience of sense pleasure, is it really a source of happiness? And to tune in with this quality of wisdom to the to see where there's unsatisfactoriness, to see the limitations of worldly pleasures, to see the constant change. These wonderful friends, you could even say. These opportunities to face up to sickness, aging, and death. Seeing how things change, seeing how health is just a temporary fortunate state, seeing how the body's constantly changing, and seeing how there's nothing in this physical realm that we can really make mine, we can really control. We have to have this, isn't it? The wisdom encourages a hands-off approach, stepping back, and learning from everything. So this quality, for me, it's very sharp, it's very bright. It's very no nonsense. And balancing that with devotion, with love of the good, with the, for me, there's a heart quality to faith. And when we do the chanting, bowing, it's an encouragement really to open up to this aspect, this friend. And I know lots of people, when they first come to the monastery, it doesn't really do anything for them. They just think it's rituals and trappings, religious trappings. It's not really liberating. It's not really a very good use of our time. I used to think of bowing just as a really good stretch for the spine. It didn't move me at all. And that's fine, of course. But there is an encouragement. These practices are actually offering an opportunity, if we like, to look at the heart quality, love of the path, love of the teachings, even like a kind of celebration of the triple gem of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. How fortunate the Buddha lived, taught, had these qualities that we recite, and the qualities of the teachings, the immediacy, the timelessness, the invitation to investigate, the way that the Dharma leads us on, leads us in. It's just an incredible journey. And to celebrate that, to make much of that and to bow to that. And the Sangha, the community. When I first came to the monastery, I didn't want to live with people. I just wanted to meditate. I wanted to be a hermit, really. But, you know, people, you had to put up with them. And I've come to realize with enormous gratitude that it's people, other people, who teach us perhaps the most. You know, the blind spots, the sharp edges, the aspects of our nature that we're not really aware of. Ignorance, by its very nature, we're not seeing certain things sometimes. And it's those ones who really irritate, wind up, get in the way, you know, who I have difficulty with. Who, you know, it's always their fault, of course, who are causing problems. These opportunities to be with other people and to rub against each other, to have experience of friction, misunderstandings, even, you know, dislike or judgmental thoughts, critical thoughts. All these ways that we can jostle each other and, you know, seemingly disturb each other's peace, there's the opportunity right there to see the pieces of our heart that we're not really conscious of, you know, the unintegrated, the dispossessed, the, you know, the dark corners. Well, my sense is that we help each other to see these things. And so Sangha, you know, for me, that's one of the aspects of Sangha, is this opportunity to practice together. So we're teaching each other. We're all teachers for each other. Whether we're, you know, wise and skillful friends, or whether we're more challenging to be around, we're still teaching each other, and we can be very grateful for that. I certainly am. And so the chanting, the bowing, you know, it's an opportunity to, to feel aversion, if that's what we feel, or to just get through, if that's how we feel, but also to explore, to perhaps make much of, perhaps allow the rejoicing, the celebrating, the lifting up of these qualities, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and allowing ourselves then to feel inspired, to feel uplifted, and to feel energized in our practice. So this quality of faith, I can see how beautifully it balances the cutting sword of wisdom, you know. It's a softer and it's a more heartful energy. And somebody asked me yesterday, I was having tea with the women guests. We had a very wonderful conversation. And one of the things we talked about was what happens, you know, when you're celibate and you're not really in relationship with people in the same way? What about all the potential we have to love and to cherish and to look after, you know, that manifests in family life? What about that, you know? Is that, do you push that away, or do you let that all go? What happens? And so that got me thinking, not thinking, but rather considering, and I've been doing that ever since. And I can't quite remember what I said, but the sense is one of nothing goes away. Come into the monastery. It's like a lot of people come to the monastery to get away from certain things, but unfortunately, no, that doesn't generally work. Everything that we try and avoid will come and confront us one way or another. In monastic life's about increasing our awareness, not getting away from things. And so what happens to these qualities? And Yes, my sense is that they simply are channeled in different directions and have their life and are very much part of the holy life. And where do they go? They go into the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. They are the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. They are awareness, truth and community. Community both externally and also internally. Like what I mean by that is the integration of the heart, the coming together, the fullness, the wholeness that can begin to manifest. And only through that wholeness can there be a real letting go. So all the devotion, the love and the all that heart energy, that is so much for me a part of the spiritual life, without which it's very dry. If there's just wisdom, it's a crucial quality. It's our great friend, yes. And it needs to balance, always needs to be present. With just devotion, we're lost. But the faith quality gives a kind of for me a there's a kind of a mercy or a compassion to our wisdom, you know. It doesn't have to be brutal. It can be a gentle constantly kind of weeding out, pruning out, letting go, moving closer towards that which is true, which is liberating, which is freeing. But with a certain care and kindness. Another thing that I just want to bring in just before I conclude this talk is that quality of kindness, and the reason I want to bring it in is because it's become, it keeps coming up. It keeps coming into conversations that I have and in my own practice too. This quality, I just want to bring in and encourage, because the practice can be sometimes, of course, very challenging, and we can be dealing with a lot of negative mind states. And most particularly, I hear again and again how people berate themselves and find themselves criticizing, judging, even disliking this one, themselves. And this again is for me a balancing act. In some senses, there's a lot of wisdom and discernment in that experience. It can teach us a great deal. The relationship we have with this mind and body. But to balance out the investigation that leads us to see, the really quite dark and difficult material that's there, that needs a good airing, that needs to be acknowledged. It's very difficult to work with unless we have this balancing quality of metta, of kindness. And it's become more and more the bedrock of my practice. And I hear from many people the same thing, that mindfulness itself, it has that quality of metta, actually, because it's with the willingness to be attentive to attend to be with, without judging or, criticizing, or without making personal our experience. The quality of metta is impersonal, it's universal. It's a general sense of well-wishing. And I have this as a background to my mindfulness practice. It's the same thing as mindfulness. So establishing at the beginning of every sitting, noticing the balancing of these energies, energy and concentration, the discerning wisdom and the love of the practice. And allowing a sense of well-wishing, of kindness, a willingness to be gentle and compassionate with whatever experience arises. We don't have to feel badly about negative emotions, mind states coming up. We can feel glad. It's like a purge. It's like a cleanse, a deep cleanse. It's a purification. How to purify without this experience of the negative, the unwholesome, the painful, the angry, fearful, hateful. You know, it's great when they come up. We can really start to see what's there and see how it arises only to pass away. But let's be like the good mother, you know. We can hold our experience in our arms and just let it be whatever it is and know that it's okay. It's all okay.